This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Oh, your radio station.
Tune into KBOO Wednesday, January 2nd at 6 p.m. for Treasures from the KBOO Archive, a monthly program celebrating 45 years of community engagement and activism, culture, and arts. Our first program features Vandana Shiva, recorded in 2002.
Chemical warfare is literally part of our everyday agriculture. It's not what happens with Saddam Hussein only. It's happening in all the fields. It's happening across the world. In fact, the chemicals were meant for war. The ones that are put into agriculture was a peaceful use of instruments of war.
That's Wednesday, January 2nd at 6 p.m. on KBOO Portland.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Yellow Pages, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New mobile applications available for iPhone and Android. For more information, you can visit pdxgyp.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, conservationists challenge the sale of large forests bordering Crater Lake National Forest.
Organic farmers in Southern Oregon want GMO crops banned.
And the FCC will investigate the cost of prison inmates keeping in touch with their families by phone.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, January 2nd, 2013. I'm Nia Lewis.
And I'm Brian Pritchett. Conservationists have challenged a proposed sale of massive log forests bordering Crater Lake National Park. The Forest Service argues that the so-called debug timber sale is part of a hazard reduction strategy to help preserve Umpqua National Forest. Activists, however, say that their reasoning is flawed and could heavily damage the environmentally rich area. KBOO's Zeke Harrington spoke with Francis Etherington, Conservation Director of Cascadia Wildlands, over the proposed logging sale.
The debug timber sale was first proposed nearly 4 years ago. Why have conservationists filed their notice of intent to challenge the proposal last month?
Well, the Forest Service just recently decided to auction off a large portion of the debug sale. It's called the Sandshed Timber Sale. And the Sandshed Timber Sale violates everything that we were concerned about the debug timber sale. It logs in a high-use recreation areas. It logs in the route that goes right up to Crater Lake National Park, logs right off Highway 38, logs right in the high-use recreation areas around Lamoille Lake, and it logs within the inventory roadless areas of Mount Bailey roadless area of a Diamond Lake. And it logs a large portion of habitat for the northern spotted owl, including critical habitat for the northern spotted owl. We objected to the Forest Service's idea in 2008 when this project started. They contended that within 5 years, 90% of the project area would be dead from bark beetles if they didn't do this logging. Well, 5 years is up, and that hasn't happened. And there's really no reason, good reason, to do this logging. At least not the reason stated.
And what is the scale and size of the currently proposed logging sale, if it was allowed to go forward?
The Sandshed Timber Sale is 643 acres, removing almost 7 million board feet of timber. And most of the timber being removed does not even contribute to the Umpqua National Forest timber target because it's in areas that were administratively withdrawn for recreation. So they're logging in recreation areas that was never intended to be for commercial harvest.
Now, what environmental impact could this logging have on the bordering areas of Crater Lake National Park and the larger areas of Umpqua National Forest?
It's hard to start to degrade high recreation use areas, as well as degrade wildlife habitat that people go to recreate for. The entire debugged timber sale, which Sanchin is part of, the entire debugged timber sale, the Forest Service thought that this sale would take, that means harm or kill, that this sale would take up to 21 spotted owls. You know, with the spotted owls on the edge of extinction, this is just too heavy an impact for a purpose that is just not come to fruition. The Forest Service will also say that we need to protect people from wildfires, and we agree that summer homes around Diamond Lake and such need to be protected from wildfires by clearing out the brush near the homes. But this sale is many, many miles from anybody's home. That's not a good reason either. Crater Lake is a little postage stamp that really depends on all its borders to supply its natural habitat. And so it's important to protect the natural ecosystems next to Crater Lake as well as Crater Lake itself, especially these areas that the Forest Service has previously chosen not to log and has set aside for recreation, not to go in there and remove 7 million board feet. That's a big, heavy impact to this area. So we're hoping the Forest Service will reconsider this sale.
Does the area being sold have any legal protections that would stop this sale from going forward?
Well, we feel as though it does. The sale, parts of the sale has been designated as critical habitat under the Endangered Species Act. And so we feel as though the Forest Service should have reconsidered the impacts of spotted owl before selling the sale. So that's what we told the Forest Service. We gave them a 60-day notice that we would like them to reconsider the sale.
I've been speaking with Frances Etherington, Conservation Director with Cascadia Wildlands. Thanks very much for taking the time out to speak with us.
You're welcome.
This is Zeke Harrington with KBOO News.
Approximately 3,000 dock workers at terminals from Portland to Seattle have returned to work despite overwhelmingly voting to reject a proposed contract. For the last week, the workers have been working with no contract and have reserved the right to strike at any time. The management for the grain terminals in question say they also reserve the right to hire temporary replacement workers, which union workers call scabs, if such a strike is declared. Management declared an impasse in talks just after Christmas, following bargaining discussions which broke down in mid-December. But labor groups contend the criteria to declare an impasse has not yet been met. Members of four chapters of the International Longshore and Warehouse Union returned to work on December 27th without a contract, as the management's best last offer was rejected by more than 90% of the union's members. The ILWU says the terms and conditions laid out in that offer provide management too much, quote, wiggle room to create new rules and impose sanctions against workers. Terminal owners claim that if a strike occurs, they stand ready with replacement labor. Neither side of the dispute could be reached for comment.
Portland Mayor Charlie Hales took the oath of office this morning before the City Council. In a 17-minute inaugural address, Mayor Hales promised to reduce spending, increase public safety, and work to improve public education. Charlie Hales also oversaw his first City Council meeting. Most of the council agenda was devoted to communications from public citizens regarding recent sexual assaults at Portland State University and issues with public housing. Also on the agenda was an insurance claim for a motor vehicle accident involving a Portland police officer and a grant for the Department of Transportation to conduct motor safety inspections. Commissioner Nick Fish briefly joked with the new mayor over the brevity of his first city council meeting.
This, I think, qualifies as the shortest agenda in the history of council. This, I think, goes to your core message about conducting this in a more businesslike fashion.
It may all be downhill from here, but we'll take it.
On Monday, Hales announced further picks for his mayoral staff, including two former members of Mayor Adams' international relations team.
Oregon's low-paid workers can celebrate the new year with a 15-cent increase in minimum wage from $8.80 per hour to $8.95 per hour. In Oregon, the change to minimum wage is automatic, resulting from Measure 25, which passed in 2002. That year, minimum wage rose from $6.50 to $6.90 per hour and required an annual increase that would compensate for inflation as measured by the Consumer Price Index in future years. Minimum wage in Oregon is the second highest in the nation, following Washington State, who raised their minimum wage to $9.19 as of January 1st. The change would equate to roughly $6 extra a week or $300 a year for one full-time minimum wage worker. Federal minimum wage remains $7.25 per hour for non-tipped workers and a staggering $2.13 per hour for workers making tips.
Some organic farmers in southern Oregon have organized to ban genetically modified crops in Jackson County. Ban supporters filed petition signatures with Jackson County's clerk office today to put a measure on the county ballot. If passed, the only genetically engineered plants allowed in the county would be for scientific research. Enforcement would be carried out by county inspections and citizen lawsuits. Chief petitioner Brian Combs said he wants to protect organic farmers who stand to lose money if their crops are contaminated by genetically engineered pollen. Jackson County Farm Bureau President Ron Bjork says he thinks most farmers would oppose an outright ban.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for Free Speech Radio News at 5:30, followed by Treasures from the KBOO Archives at 6. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather is cold and cloudy, with a chance of freezing rain and a high temperature of 38 degrees Fahrenheit.
It's 5:12. Time now for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Washington keeps handing massive bailouts to Wall Street giants and multi-billion dollar annual subsidies to the likes of Big Oil, which is a nice boost to the bottom lines of the one percenters. But these giveaways do absolutely nothing to perk up America's grassroots economy, which not only is where the rest of us live and work, but also is the only place that can generate real national prosperity. Congress can't seem to grasp a basic law of nature. You can't keep a mighty tree alive, much less expect it to thrive, by only spritzing the fine leaves at its tippy top. The fate of the whole tree depends on nurturing the grassroots. Sadly, America's corporate and political powers today are content to be a bunch of leaf spritzers, blithely oblivious to the dangerous shriveling of the grassroots. To witness the damage they're doing, just look at our nation's desiccated minimum wage. Set at $7.25 an hour 3 years ago, its real value has since been gutted by inflation, reducing the wage's current purchasing power to a sub-poverty level of $6.75 an hour. That's only $14,000 a year for full-time work. Not only would increasing it help these hard-working people make ends meet, but it also would provide a direct jolt of nourishment to our overall economy. It's been shown again and again that every dime of a minimum wage hike is spent by its recipients, circulating upward in our local economies as they increase their purchases of such basics as food, kids' clothing, and health care. This is Jim Hightower saying, this kind of percolate-up economics works for the many, not just the wealthiest few, and that helps, at least minimally, to restore a bit of moral balance to an economy and society now being torn apart by gross inequality. For more information on raising today's poverty wage, go to timeforaraise.org.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
The Buffalo Field campaign declared a small victory today upon reaching a settlement for the release of documents under the Freedom of Information Act, known as its acronym FOIA. The nonprofit campaign, which advocates for the survival of the nation's last herd of wild buffalo, filed the lawsuit after a federal agency failed to respond to FOIA requests for documents about the agency's buffalo management program. The federal agency known as APHIS, the U.S. Department of Agriculture, Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service, regulates the control of livestock and wild herds like buffalo. Daryl Geist is a representative of the Buffalo Field Campaign.
It's not well understood by the public, or not well known, that this agency, APHIS, is intensively involved in managing bison that originate from Yellowstone National Park. And most of our Freedom of Information Act requests were about their involvement. For example, bison are captured inside Yellowstone National Park and put into quarantine, and APHIS is the agency responsible for that. And we had asked the agency to disclose the injuries, the bison deaths of this population that was subject to quarantine, because it does happen. Now, we found numerous instances of bison dying in quarantine, bison being injured in quarantine. They're intensively handled, and there was deaths and injuries to the bison that just were not being reported and not being disclosed. We submitted a Freedom of Information Act request on, for example, APHIS was funding the Department of Livestock helicopter that was coming in and in the springtime and forcing bison, forcing bison off their spring range, where the grass is greening up, and with helicopters, and this was impacting grizzly bears. So one of the Freedom of Information Act requests we asked for was to disclose that financial relationship, because all the money was coming from APHIS to fund that helicopter that was disturbing the grizzly bears, as well as forcing the bison to flee Hebgen Basin. Sixth Freedom of Information Act request had been delayed significantly. We're talking months here. The Freedom of Information Act has very strict timelines for response. We felt that the APHIS had engaged in this pattern of practice of withholding documents, so we filed suit. Buffalo Field Campaign, we're the number one source of news on America's last wild bison, and we need those records, those government records, to critically review what the government's doing with our money to our wildlife on our public lands. And if we have to file suit under the Freedom of Information Act to get those records, we'll do so again. So we're, our position is these records are public and they're newsworthy, and today, with our release of our lawsuit settlement, we posted a new webpage that discloses all of the documents, all of the letters we received in the context of this lawsuit and settlement on the Freedom of Information Act.
A separate Freedom of Information Act lawsuit was dismissed by a federal judge today. The lawsuit involved a request to release documents related to the U.S. government's policy of targeted assassinations of U.S. citizens. The American Civil Liberties Union sued for the release of records on the targeted killings of Anwar al-Awlaki and Samir Khan, as well as al-Awlaki's 16-year-old son. These assassinations were carried out by drone missile strikes by U.S. forces in Yemen in 2011. According to the ACLU, the public has a right to know more about the circumstances in which the government believes it can lawfully kill people, including U.S. citizens, who are far from any battlefield and who have never been charged with a crime. The group plans to appeal the judge's decision and called on the government to voluntarily make the documents public. In addition to this lawsuit and another one demanding the release of secret documents, the ACLU has also filed a lawsuit questioning whether the targeted assassination program violates the Constitution.
The Buffalo Field Campaign declared a small victory today upon reaching a settlement for the release of documents under the Freedom of Information Act. Excuse me, that was the wrong story. All right. Employees in five U.S. states are now protected against demands by employers to share the login information of their Facebook and other social media accounts. In early 2012, the American Civil Liberties Union stepped in when job applicants in Maryland complained that potential employers were requesting that they surrender their Facebook and email passwords. The ACLU argued that this practice was an invasion of privacy. The state passed the first bill of its kind in April, suppressing the demands for passwords. Requests for passwords cease, but employers began asking their workers to log into social networking sites in their presence, browsing through information while an interviewer watched. Public outcry over the issue prompted Facebook to stand up, claiming that the practice was against their terms of service. Legislation went into effect yesterday in Illinois and California, making it illegal for employees to ask for the email and social media passwords of their workers. In Illinois, the privacy restrictions were made by an amendment to the Right to Privacy in the Workplace Act. A similar bill was signed by Michigan Governor Rick Snyder on Friday, going a step further to protect students. The bill stops educational institutions from dismissing or failing to admit students who fail to provide content from their Facebook, Twitter, or email accounts. Employers will still be able to view public content shared by prospective employees who have not changed their privacy settings.
The Federal Communications Commission will decide whether the cost for families to stay in touch with incarcerated loved ones by phone is too high. Activists say the FCC's investigation is the result of more than 10 years of lobbying, and there's still much to be done. In collaboration with the Oregon News Service, KBOO's Ben Renner has more.
In a move announced at year's end, the FCC will soon examine the high prices families pay to stay in touch by phone with loved ones behind bars. A 15-minute phone call made from prison can cost family members up to $20. In announcing a notice of proposed rulemaking, the FCC has responded to an effort of more than 10 years regarding prison phone service contacts. Stephen Renderos, a national organizer on the issue, says the step forward is great.
The real victims of the high cost of these phone calls are the families that have to pay the phone bill. It's not the inmates themselves, it's the families that end up paying the phone bills.
Renderos and others credit stepped-up activism over the past year or so, including support from the makers of a recent feature film called Middle of Nowhere, about prisoners' families. It was shown last fall at a special Washington, D.C. screening for FCC staff and commissioners. The commission was responding to a petition filed years ago on behalf of Martha Wright, a grandmother of a former prison inmate. One of her attorneys, Lee Petro, credits the breakthrough to pressure from public interest groups, as well as the screening of Middle of Nowhere.
A comprehensive showing from all different angles, from the right, the conservative organizations, from the left, as well as, you know, doing a showing at the FCC of the movie, really put the pressure on the FCC and the FCC staff to explain why there hasn't been action over the past 10 years.
Coming so close to year's end, Petro says the FCC's move didn't get as much publicity as it might have, but he calls it an important step nonetheless. And now they'll have to convince the FCC to come up with rules capping the onerous phone rates. Renderos says family contact with incarcerated loved ones is essential, and it often has to be by telephone.
The Federal Bureau of Prisons acknowledged themselves that phone calls play a very critical role in reducing recidivism. There's been countless studies done about the frequency and contact with families and how that's necessary.
This is Ben Renner with KBOO News in collaboration with the Oregon News Service.
The U.S. House barely passed a deal yesterday to avert the so-called fiscal cliff, and while Oregon's delegation was generally opposed to the bill, three of the seven Oregon representatives did vote in favor of the deal. Senators Wyden and Merkley both voted in favor, but with some reservations. Senator Wyden compared the process that led up to this deal as being straight out of the movie Thelma and Louise. And Senator Merkley voted for the deal despite having quite, quote, misgivings. He warned that the fiscal cliff deal passed yesterday sets the stage for future cliffs and potential cuts to Social Security and other entitlements. But Merkley added that without the bill, 30,000 Oregonians would have been, quote, cut off at the knees. Oregon's one Republican representative in Congress, Greg Walden, who represents the eastern two-thirds of the state, said that the deal, which just passed, will now allow the president to deal with the nation's biggest problem, which is deficit reduction. Representative Earl Blumenauer, whose district covers most of Portland, released a video explaining why he voted against the fiscal cliff deal.
This evening, we're expected to vote on an item that has many commendable, important items. Unfortunately, too many are of short duration, much is left out, and most importantly, we're losing a real opportunity for reform. The SGR is left in a year to torment medical providers again. The ATM, I'm pleased, is patched, and I appreciate the advocacy of my friend Mr. Neal. But in fact, we all know that it should, at a minimum, be reformed, if not repealed. We have a body blow to the alternative energy industry, and somehow it's given a year's reprieve, but it's not what they need or what they deserve. And because we refuse, at a moment of opportunity, to deal meaningfully with the national debt. And remember, the budget from my Republican friends, authored by my colleague Mr. Ryan, would have required $6 trillion headroom in the debt ceiling. Now, we cannot continue to have the world's largest and most expensive military by far, the lowest taxes of any of the major economies, the most expensive and inefficient health care, and continue to allow our country's infrastructure to fall apart while America ages and grows. This proposal represents absolutely the least we could have done under these circumstances, and tragically institutionalizes for the next Congress the madness around here of short-term frenzy around self-inflicted deadlines that have no reality to them. That drives the American public crazy, and with good reason. Not only can we do better, I would suggest that we must do better. May I have 20 more seconds?
Surely, 20 seconds.
The gentleman is recognized for an additional 20 seconds.
It's probably going to pass with overwhelming bipartisan support. So be it. I can only hope that that spirit of taking a risk on both sides of the aisle and both parties and the administration, that the Obama administration and the new Congress get serious about reform and delivering services more cost-effectively in ways, ironically, that people on both sides of the aisle agree with, but are absent in this proposal. Thank you, and I yield back.
That was Oregon Representative Earl Blumenauer speaking on why he voted against the fiscal cliff deal that was approved by Congress yesterday.
One of the bills left by the wayside as 2012 came to an end was a proposed extension of the Violence Against Women Act. This was the first time since its passage in 1994 that the act was not renewed. The Violence Against Women Act is a bipartisan effort to fund restitution for victims of domestic violence and investigations of violent crimes against women. Analysts were caught off guard at the last minute obstruction of the bill, which had been on track to pass fairly easily, as it had in 2000 and again in 2005. Senator Patty Murray of Washington blamed House Republicans for obstructing the passage of the bill and called their actions inexcusable. A recent report from the Bureau of Justice Statistics found that there was a 64% decline in intimate partner violence from 1993 to 2010. The National Network to End Domestic Violence said that the Violence Against Women Act has played a critical role in this remarkable decline. The group condemned the congressional failure to extend the bill for the next 5 years. The failure will result in a significant loss of funding for domestic violence programs across the country.
Oregon wind power companies breathed a sigh of relief as the wind energy tax credit was included in the final version of the fiscal cliff deal passed yesterday. But the one-year extension of the tax credit will not be enough to provide support for long-term projects. The credit allows new wind power generation plants to go online this year and next year with a guaranteed tax credit worth just over 2 cents per kilowatt hour of electricity. Thousands of workers have already been laid off due to the uncertainty of the future of the wind tax credit, including several hundred here in Oregon.
According to the Associated Press and the UN, 60,000 people have died since the civil war started in Syria 21 months ago. Most of the deaths have occurred in Homs, Aleppo, and in the suburbs of Damascus, where the regime of Bashar al-Assad is making what some are calling a last stand against rebels. The casualty figures were compiled by comparing the results of seven separate sources, including the Britain-based Syrian Observatory for Human Rights and the Syrian government, both of whom had lower initial casualty figures than the UN. The death toll made no distinction between civilian and combat deaths or quantities of government and rebel soldiers.
Afghan warlord Gabuddin Hekmentyar vowed in an interview published earlier today to kill as many Western soldiers as possible before NATO troops pull out of Afghanistan in 2014. Hekmentyar, a former prime minister and leader of the country's second largest military force, the Hezb-e-Islami, told Britain's Daily Telegraph that he wants to send a message to future invaders of his country. He warned that Afghanistan will descend into civil war after NATO troops withdraw.
And now the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Wednesday, January 2nd, 2013. Israeli soldiers attack fishermen in Gaza and arrest residents from the West Bank. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. The Israeli Navy opened fire on Wednesday morning at a number of Palestinian fishing boats at the coast of Khan Yunis and Rafah in the southern part of the Gaza Strip. Local sources reported that the army fired dozens of rounds of live ammunition at the fishing boats and forced the fishermen to return to their docks. The sources added that the Navy chased the fishermen despite the fact that they were in the allotted area allowed for Palestinian fishermen. As part of the ceasefire agreement that ended the Israeli war on Gaza in November 2012, Palestinian fishermen were allowed to fish within 6 nautical miles of the Gaza coast. 191 Palestinians, including children, women and elderly, have been killed by Israeli military fire in Gaza in November, including those killed during the war, while the number of injured Palestinians in the same month reached 1,492. Elsewhere, Israeli soldiers kidnapped on Wednesday at dawn 4 Palestinian former political prisoners in the Beit Umar town north of the southern West Bank city of Hebron. Several residents were wounded during clashes that took place with the invading soldiers. Local sources reported that among those arrested were Yusuf Abu Maria, an activist with the Popular Committee Against the Wall and Settlement.